Alaska tribes can ask the Interior Secretary to put land into trust status for them. But what does that mean? I'm Lori Townsend, and today we'll work to clarify what the legal distinction known as Indian Country means and what it does not. The state is challenging the Secretary's authority to take land into trust for Alaska tribes. But if that suit fails, what could the future of land holdings look like in Alaska? The legal meaning of trust land status is our topic today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a three-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. Although Alaska Native people have occupied the lands here since time immemorial, the legal status of Native lands in Alaska has a long and complicated history. We're going to peel back some of those layers today as we discuss what the future of land and sovereign government authority might look like in the future. Here to clarify the legal issues for us is attorney Lloyd Miller. Welcome, Lloyd.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. I should also mention that we tried to get someone from the state's Department of Law to be on today's program to articulate the state's concerns within their appeal, but they did not make someone available. We will also, at a later point in the show today, be talking a bit about the Rama Navajo settlement with the BIA and how that impacts Alaska tribes. So there's a lot to discuss today. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have questions about what land into trust will mean for Alaska tribes and for the state of Alaska, you can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255 statewide, or in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Lloyd, it seems like this case largely comes down to Section 5 of the Indian Reorganization Act, although there's a lot of complex legal layers, and I want us to delve into some of those. But the ability of the secretary to take land into trust is within that section. That's what the Federal Register called the capstone of the Indian Reorganization Act. The IRA is Section 5. That gives the secretary that authority. Walk us through the IRA regulations, which had a provision that excluded Alaska tribes from trust consideration, other than Metlakatla, which we'll discuss in a little bit.
Sure. First, let's maybe walk it back a little bit. When the at the time the IRA was considered, trust status had been lost on most Native lands, and as a result, over 90% and 90 million acres have been lost from Native ownership to non-Native ownership across the United States. The loss of trust title, the loss of Native lands, was devastating to Native American communities. The IRA was a very well-intentioned and well-executed attempt to stem that trend and to secure to tribes the ability to recover their lands. So Section 5 authorizes the Secretary of the Interior to acquire lands in trust for tribes, and that process has proceeded forward, often slowly, often frustratingly. Interestingly, Section 5 was not initially applicable in Alaska. When the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act was first adopted, only five sections of the Act applied to Alaska Natives. 2 years later, the Act was not working because there weren't reservations in Alaska, and a lot of the language used in the IRA was key to Indians on a reservation. So Congress, 2 years later, enacted a two-section statute, the 1936 Alaska Native Reorganization Act. Section 1 expanded the application of the IRA, made seven more sections applicable to Alaska, which included Section 5. And Section 2 of that 1936 Act also authorized the Secretary to declare new reservations in Alaska. I mention all that because when the land claim settlement came through It did not touch any provision of the IRA. It did not touch any provision of the Alaska Reorganization Act of 1936. A few years later, Congress would repeal Section 2 of the 1936 Act, but it would leave in place Section 1 of that act, which had made Section 5 of the IRA apply to Alaska. So you fast forward into the 70s, and the question is then on the minds of people at the Department of the Interior, does the Secretary's authority to take lands into trust in Alaska survive the land claim statute? Well, it's an interesting question, and it was answered positively. In 1978 and 1979, there were opinions written inside the Interior Department that, yes, that authority hadn't been repealed, and the general rule is if something hasn't been repealed, it still remains effective. And one attorney, an associate solicitor for Indian Affairs named Tom Fredericks, took a different view when he was assessing specifically the Native Village of Venati's request to have lands taken into trust. He decided that although the IRA Section 5's application to Alaska hadn't been repealed, it would still be an abuse of discretion for the secretary to take ANCSA land or former ANCSA land, land claim settlement land that had gone from a corporation to a tribe. It would be an abuse of discretion for the secretary to take it into trust. So he declined to do so. Regulations which were being written at that time were proposed, which had no Alaska exception, but because of these intervening events, when they were finally published in 1980, there was an Alaska exception, which said the secretary had no authority to acquire land and trust in Alaska except for the Metlakatla Reserve, which is a bit ironic because the Metlakatla Reserve was set aside for a Canadian tribe that came into the territory of Alaska.
It seems like that's kind of, that's an interesting point, that language, and from what I've read about that, it sort of just appeared when the regulation got published in 1980. What's known about the history of that? Was the congressional delegation aware of that, or did it just all of a sudden pop up? It seems somewhat hard to believe that it would have just appeared and no one, that it took everyone by surprise.
Well, as I say, the Fredericks opinion, as it's been known to be, the Fredericks opinion was later endorsed by the acting solicitor at the time, and the notice and comment period had already occurred in the Federal Register, and the next step was issuing the final regulation. They could have, and I think should have, re-noticed the regulation with this new language, because there had never been notice to the public that they were going to have an Alaska exclusion or an Alaska exception. Be that as it may, they were already late. Already 2 years had passed since they'd done the notice and comment, and they wanted to get the regulation done. They were looking at a change of administration potentially, so the final regulation was issued with that exception.
When the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSA, was passed in 1971, Alaska state leaders, at the very least, thought that that was the final word on tribal lands. Many people thought that was the final word on any kind of settlements, on any kind of land, tribal lands issue. Corporations were formed, tribal members became shareholders. How are tribal members, ANC shareholders in Alaska, legally different today, setting aside the land into trust issue for just a moment? What's the legal distinction between Alaska tribal shareholder members and tribal members on reservations in the lower 48?
The legal difference between tribal members in Alaska and tribal members in the lower 48 primarily turns on the absence of a territory. Tribes have authority over their members, and thanks to the authority over their members, they're able to take certain actions to protect their members or to prosecute their members, and certainly to do such measures as protection of children, protection of women from terrors or domestic violence. But there's no defined territory when you don't have a reservation or you don't have trust lands. And that has been a difficulty for Alaska tribes, and that's the greatest difference. It's also a practical difference. There are hundreds of millions of dollars of federal programs whose eligibility turns on whether or not a tribe owns trust lands. There are many other programs that don't, but a significant number of programs that do, because the federal government has seen fit to support tribal economic development, tribal environmental initiatives, all the good governance things we want to see tribes able to do, but often the criteria for receiving that financial support from the federal government is the presence of trust land. For this reason, among others, Alaska tribes are really pressing hard to secure their right to have trust status. I should tell you, the most important one is one that's often overlooked. Trust status is the gold standard for the perpetual preservation of native lands in native ownership. There is nothing like it. And the first reason, the foremost reason why Alaska tribes want to have lands held in trust, because you would think it might be a little odd to want somebody else to hold your land for you, much less the federal government, given the history of relations at times between tribes and the federal government. But it is because that is the highest level of perpetual protection you can have for native lands.
Certainly. So this isn't a question of sovereignty, because Alaska tribal people are sovereigns without territorial reach. I think that's sort of the legal description of what Alaska tribes have been up until this time. And now let's talk about this lawsuit that is changing that legal definition. The Akyechak lawsuit, bring us up to date on the case and the current status of it.
Well, the Akyechak lawsuit began as a petition, a rulemaking petition. It asked the Secretary of the Interior to repeal the Alaska exception. The Secretary failed to do that, although legal opinions were issued starting in the late 90s, questioning the earlier legal opinions that had issued from the Department of the Interior. So in the late 1990s, solicitors and associate solicitors for Indian Affairs were opining that the Secretary's authority to take lands into trust in Alaska had never been repealed, and that the regulations were not based on a solid legal foundation. Eventually, the petition was converted into a lawsuit because the department would not take action. There were attempts to take action, but they failed. And when one reads the court opinion issued in 2013 by Judge Contreras in Washington, D.C., I must say, as many court opinions strike us at times, it's stupidly simple, and you wonder what the big fuss was about. After all, when the Settlement Act was enacted, Congress was aware of the multiplicity of other laws on the books dealing with native lands issues. Congress was aware of the Alaska Native Allotment Act. Congress was aware of the Alaska Native Townside Act. Congress was aware of the IRA, the presence of reservations, the presence of trust lands. Congress was aware of all this. You look at the record, it's all there. But Congress dealt surgically with land claims issues. That was the job, had to clear the way for statehood act selections, clear the way for oil and gas development. Congress enacted a land claim statute and didn't try to develop a grand field theory for all things, and certainly left in place a multiplicity of land regimes. It left in place the Alaska Native Townside Act. It left in place thousands of Alaska Native allotments. It left in place at least three parcels at the time that were trust parcels outside of Indian reservations. And Congress would deal with these things later. It eventually would repeal the Townside Act. It would eventually repeal Section 2 of the 1936 Act, but it left in place Section 1. We presume that Congress is acting coherently and intentionally, and the role of the courts is not to rewrite laws the way some people would like them to be. The role of the courts is to interpret the laws that Congress has enacted, and people can go back to Congress if they think Congress should do something different. So the lawsuit was filed, and Judge Contreras ruled that since Congress had never repealed this authority, the authority remained in place. The state argued, not the federal government, that there was tension between a land claims regime of ANCSA lands held by ANCSA corporations and some lands being reconveyed to municipalities. There was tension between that and the regime of having trust lands owned by tribes. But he said, my job as a judge is to try to keep all laws in effect if they're not irreconcilable. And he said, I think correctly in this regard, that they're not irreconcilable. You have many different types of Alaska Native land ownership, town sites, allotments, ANCSA land, trust land, and now the possibility of additional trust land. And so he sustained the claim that this authority had never been repealed. The federal government initially took an appeal and then decided instead to amend the regulations and get rid of the Alaska exception. There was a long comment period. There were hearings in Alaska. And after that, the rule was finalized repealing the Alaska exception. So actually, one of your callers may notice this, there's no lawsuit anymore. The lawsuit was to invalidate a regulation, but the regulation was voluntarily withdrawn by the government. So one would think there's no lawsuit anymore. The federal government recently filed a motion bringing that to the Court of Appeals' attention that the lawsuit, the appeal, which was filed by the state, should really be dismissed. The state did not consent to the motion, but the state may yet respond by agreeing. It has the power to do that, or it may not.
And there's a deadline, I think, of the end of October for people, tribes, and others to file briefs in this latest...
That's right. Both the federal government and the original AccuCheck plaintiffs, four tribes and one individual, have until the end of October to file responsive briefs. The briefing schedule may be altered by the federal government's motion. The federal government's asked the District of Columbia Court of Appeals to change the briefing schedule to first consider this motion.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining our conversation, this is Talk of Alaska, and it's AFN week, so we're talking about tribal issues today on Talk of Alaska. We're talking about land into trust. We're also going to be looking at the Rama Navajo settlement a little later in the program. But if you have questions about what taking land into trust means, you can call us at 1-800-478-8255 statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. Is your tribe or are you preparing an application for trust status for lands? Maybe your tribe has already submitted one. Give us a call if that's the case. What do you think trust status would mean for tribes, and what would it mean for the state? Do you think the state should continue its legal challenge or drop it? The Walker administration has had a much better relationship with tribes in Alaska than some previous administrations. Were you surprised that they decided to press on with this appeal?
Initially, I was, because all indications from the Walker administration were that the administration was going to strike a different course than the prior administration on this issue. But I also took the governor and the attorney general at their word that what they were doing was re-examining the issue. And when the deadline came to file the brief, they were going to file their briefs, but that they were continuing to reassess the state's position. The lieutenant governor recently spoke to the Association of Village Council Presidents Convention a few days ago and said that the governor supports the ability of local tribes to ask the secretary to acquire lands into trust. And that's something we should talk about later, the fact that it's only making a request. The governor supports that, but the governor has some issues, details, and I think those concerns that the governor has are reasonable concerns that reasonable people could talk about. After all, the regulations that were written in 1980, because of the history I told you about, were never written with Alaska in mind. Alaska is not mentioned except in the exception. The language of the regulations, talking about states and counties, we don't have counties in Alaska. Mm-hmm. There's just... it's an ill-conceived regulation if you want to have it work in Alaska. It can probably be shoehorned. Alaska can be shoehorned into it. But at least some clarification, maybe guidelines that aren't regulatory, or even perhaps amendments to the regulations. Many ANCSA corporations who supported the trust land process, and I think the governor, according to the lieutenant governor, supports the process, also want to see amendments to the regulations to clarify some issues, provide for greater comment period, and the like. I think that's productive.
I want to talk about what the application process and all that involves, but let's parse out the legal language here. What's the legal difference today of an area of land in trust or Indian country status, that legal definition, as opposed to a tribe's fee simple land that was part of the ANCSA settlement?
All right. Now, let's complicate it more. And what's the difference between that and the ANCSA corporation, land owned by an ANCSA corporation?
Right.
Land in fee simple status is land that a tribe can regulate as a, maybe the regulation is the wrong word, can regulate in a manner of speaking in the same way that you can regulate your own house.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, this is your property after all, but you're subject to the full jurisdiction of the city of Anchorage and the state of Alaska in all respects. If that land were trust land, that statement might not be true for the trust land owner. So the tribe, as a fee owner, certainly has the power to keep people off their own land and to get rid of trespassers and do whatever they want to do with regard to fee land in that respect. But it doesn't have this added protection that trust lands have. However, if the tribe is organized under the Indian Reorganization Act, the tribe can resist the payment of taxes on that land, which would be appropriate, and that authority was sustained by the Alaska Supreme Court many years ago in a case commonly called the Nome Eskimo Community case. lands owned by a ANCSA corporation are different yet again. If they're not developed, they're also not taxable, if they're undeveloped lands. And they are protected by what's called the automatic land bank provisions of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So they have similar protections to Indian Reorganization Act tribally owned fee lands, but not exactly the same, and certainly not the higher level of protection that trust land status has. I think the greatest level of protection from trust land status comes from the fact that that land cannot be lost accidentally, involuntarily. Can't be condemned. It takes partnership with the United States Secretary of the Interior for that land to be leased or lost. And that's a critical protection.
So it couldn't be seized if an owner was in dispute about some legal financial issue. Someone couldn't go to court and say, I want to seize their property.
Right.
Because it's in trust status.
That's right. And tribes can do when they have fee land is they can resist those attempts, either if they are an IRA tribe using the authority they have under Section 16 of the IRA, which was also never repealed, or if they are being sued, of course, and this land is owned by the tribe, and the tribe can invoke its sovereign immunity from suit, and unless the tribe has waived it, then the tribe should be able to avoid the loss of that land.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on the line, and please feel free to join our conversation if you have questions about how tribes taking land into trust will affect you as a tribal member or will affect you as an Alaskan who is not a tribal member. You can call our number here statewide at 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. Roger is on the line from White Mountain. Good morning, Roger.
Oh, good morning. Real short comment. The federal government recognizes the tribes of Alaska. You've got federal lands in Alaska, also 44 million acres for Alaskan tribes, and the state owns the bulk of the rest, minus private lands. That said, how large is the state of Alaska's holdings? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Roger.
Well, in broad round numbers, the Statehood Act entitled the state to secure title to over 100 million acres of the over 300 million acres that constitute the body of Alaska. As the caller mentioned, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act corporations were entitled to select and received 44 million acres.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the application process for trust to apply to put land into trust. Right now, tribes in Alaska can do that. There can't be a final decision
they can certainly put
their requests in. They can be applying right now. That can all that work can be done. The thing that's the hang up right now is until this appeal is resolved one way or another, the application can't be finalized, but tribes have the ability right now to make that trust application. What does it involve?
Preparing a complete trust land application is an exceedingly difficult, time-consuming, and costly process. This is where I think a reality check is needed to those folks who are concerned that millions of acres are going to move into trust. And just a couple of data points might help listeners who are, if they're concerned, I'm not sure why they should be concerned, but in any event. The Obama administration has been the most aggressive administration in taking lands into trust. Over the course of over 6 years, they've taken over 200,000 acres. That's it. It's a very arduous process.
And you said they've
been
the most aggressive?
And they have been the most aggressive. And the Cobell litigation gave a shot in the arm for additional acquisitions and of trust lands, and yet only 200,000, 250,000 acres. You could double it, 400,000 acres. It still is a drop in the bucket when you consider the number of tribes around the United States that are trying to secure trust land title to their original Aboriginal territories. So a reality check is needed.
200,000 out of the 90 million that were lost through the years.
That's exactly right. The process, as you asked about, is quite difficult. There has to be an appropriate survey of the parcel. There has to be an environmental review of the parcel. The environmental reviews can be merely an environmental assessment or something more significant. Depends. Title has to be checked and verified. So if you have a trust land application which is perfectly submitted, you still may not get that one approved for years. If there are any problems in it, by the time it gets to the top of the list and somebody at the Bureau of Indian Affairs looks at it and goes through the checklist, they send it back and they say, I'm sorry, we need a new environmental review because maybe the last time the work was done was too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very difficult process. It is only a request. And although the secretary historically does not deny a lot of applications, that's because what happens is applications that are unsuccessful get withdrawn. Nobody wants to have denial of their application, so the federal bureaucrats, and I don't mean that disparagingly, let the tribal applicant know, look, I'm going to have to deny this because you're missing three or four elements. Why don't you just withdraw it and resubmit it when you're ready?
Mm.
And that's really what happens.
Mm-hmm. Will, let's return to the phones here for a call from Stu in Muldoon. Hello, Stu.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I don't claim to understand this stuff totally, but I do remember out in Prince William Sound back in the 70s, we could basically go hunt on Latouche Island and some of the other islands in the area. And then Native Claims came along, and Latouche went to, I think it's Chenega Corp, and now you can only go within like 200 yards of the beach. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go inland on the corporation lands, you need to go talk to Chenega Corp and get a permit, and you can do it, but you have to pay, three figures for a certain number of days, and they need to know who's going and things like that, which seems fair as private property. But I'm wondering if this change in the law is going to result in more places that the general public's using now becoming Native corporation lands, and where we're going to have to start going to get permits, and know which islands are owned by who, rather than just assuming everything's in the Chugach National Forest. And also, there's plenty of places around where we know the Natives are there. Their cabins are, collapsed and things. And is this going to result in corporations coming back after these lands that people have been basically using for... Well, since white folks showed up.
Thanks for the call, Stu. And I think it's important, Lloyd, I'm sure you'll make this point, that we're not talking about corporations here taking land into trust. We're talking about tribes. And we need to, maybe that needs to be the point of clarity that needs to be made now in response to Stu's questions about what will change for land use in the future. Corporations can't apply to put land into trust.
That's correct. Only an Indian tribe can. Under the Indian Reorganization Act and the implementing regulations, ask that lands be taken into trust. There's been a long history, Stu, of non-Indians, white people, trespassing on Native lands to hunt and fish. It's understandable that occurred. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was an effort to try to sort all that out, extinguish the claims that the Native people had and the tribes had. Over those trespasses, but secure title to 44 million acres and pay some compensation for the other title to the other lands that were being wiped out. And so that was a payment of $964 million. I think you will not see, if the trust land acquisition process moves forward in Alaska, substantial parcels of land moving from non-Native ownership into Native ownership. I think what you will see is a conversion of Native-owned lands from one form of ownership, which is already Native-owned lands, into another form of ownership, still Native-owned lands, but held in trust. So if you were not able to go in an area without a permit because it was Native-owned land, you still would probably need a permit to go into that area. And it wouldn't matter in that regard whether the land was owned by ANCSA Regional or Village Corporation, or the land was owned by a tribe in fee, or the land was owned by the federal government in trust for the tribe. Either way, you'd be a trespasser unless you proceeded with with proper permission.
It's private land, a lot of other distinctions that are private land.
People assume that a lot of the land is at issue is going to be Anxa land, but in fact, there's a lot of other land that Native tribes own, former church properties and other lands, historic sites, that they'd like to have taken into trust to protect them permanently. And those are the kinds of lands that we're talking about as well.
We are talking today about taking land into trust, a legal distinction that tribes have the ability to apply for now in Alaska. That's been reaffirmed, their ability to make application to the Secretary of Interior. The state is challenging that. We're talking about land into trust issues with my guest today on Talk of Alaska. Lloyd Miller is an attorney who deals with tribal litigation issues. And we will continue the conversation and take your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking today because it's AFN Convention Week here in Anchorage. Alaska Federation of Natives is having its annual gathering here in town. So there's lots and lots of folks in Anchorage this week. And we are discussing tribal issues on Talk of Alaska today. My guest is Lloyd Miller, and we're talking about land into trust and what that means for tribes, for the state of Alaska, and what the future might look like once tribes apply for trust status of lands and what that means. Lloyd, let's talk about how this potentially will impact the state. What does it mean for the state if there are lands put into trust status?
I think the impact on the state has been overblown. Probably I should also say in a complimentary fashion that the impact for the tribes has perhaps been overblown. Let's break that down. As a result of laws enacted by Congress in the 1950s, including one law that's commonly known as Public Law 280, the state of Alaska has complete law enforcement jurisdiction over every corner of the state, whether it's trust land, Indian country, no matter what you call it, it is under state jurisdiction. For purposes of criminal law. And that's important. It's important for the state to know that there's no threat to the state's authority in that domain by virtue of land being in trust status. Now, for the tribes, if land is in trust status, it enhances the ability of the tribes to regulate that land and to enforce criminal laws on those lands. The problem really is that it's neither a monumental challenge to state jurisdiction, nor is it a panacea for the tribes, because whatever happens only happens with regard to the particular parcels of land we are talking about. Because of that, the real challenge for Alaska Native communities has little to do with the trust land issue. The real challenge for Alaska Native communities is to secure the ability to regulate in their communities regardless of who owns the land. And when I use as an example your home, which I know is in Anchorage, the city of Anchorage doesn't own your land, and the state of Alaska doesn't own your land, and yet they both have jurisdiction over your land. The important thing, I think, for the future of Alaska Native communities is to sever the idea of land ownership from tribal jurisdiction. What we really need is a new regime in the villages which cements the ability of the tribes to regulate affairs in their communities, to to protect women and children from domestic violence, to control alcohol and drugs, to provide for the betterment of the communities. Now, we've had many members of Congress who have these ideas as well. Senator Begich, former Senator Begich, had a couple of bills he introduced over time. Senator Murkowski has had ideas about this. Congressman Don Young has had ideas about this. They understand that all the conversation about trust, land, and sovereignty put aside, there is a pressing public service need in the villages, which only the villages can take care of, whether it's protecting the community from dangerous people in the community or helping to provide better resources for the community. And the village tribal government is the only government there. They need to be given the tools to exercise that authority. And trust land, in some respects, is a sideshow. It's an important issue, but it is not going to get Alaska village tribal governments to the ultimate place where they seek to arrive, which is a place where they have the authority to govern their communities, to provide for the health and public safety of their communities without regard to land titles, just like every other government does. Governmental jurisdiction in an area doesn't depend on land title.
But wouldn't, if a tribe applied to have their native town site, say, maybe they've got a 20-mile, I talked to a former attorney general about this concept. Why not put a quasi-border around Native communities and say, okay, within this 30-mile radius, the tribe has authority? If they were to get that land put into trust around their community, wouldn't that give them the ability then to apply for tribal law enforcement funds from the federal government, to be able to get tribal grants or federal grants for maybe building the structure for tribal courts?
It would.
And then allow them to have a greater degree of legal jurisdiction within that Indian country, that trust land area.
Right, it would. And you didn't mention it, but another purpose that's frequently the motivator for trust land status is to improve housing in the community. It would do all of those things for the lands that went into trust.
Sure.
But if you look at a native town site, there are lands owned by non-natives that are in fee status that would not be acquired in trust. There are lands owned by individual native people. If the tribe is seeking to have land taken into trust, it wouldn't be that land. Those individual people would have to request that their lands be taken into trust. So then you have leftover lands, surplus lands in the town site that were never subdivided, which have been transferred to the tribe and are owned in a restricted fee title as a result of other litigation, including the Alegnagik litigation. And that land, streets, alleys, and some of the vacant lands, park lands that were set aside for parks, could go into trust status, and the tribe could regulate those lands. But what about the other lands that I just mentioned would not be in trust status? Yes, nonetheless, the tribe could access and compete for hundreds of millions of dollars in federal resources that are only available to tribes that have trust lands, and that would be very important. But it would not be the complete jurisdiction that tribes aspire to. So it's an important first step, and it does bring important resources into the community, and for that reason, tribes are championing this very powerfully. But the second step, I think, is to look more broadly away from land titles to the entire community and see if it's not possible to fashion a regime which is not so rooted in land titles.
Mm-hmm. I can see that point now, because it's still going to be a patchwork of jurisdiction. It wouldn't be as clean as the borders around a reservation, where you absolutely know what the legal jurisdiction is within that area. So Now we would still have town sites that maybe have some trust land area, but there would be private holdings too. And so there's still a mishmash of legal authority in those places. I think that's an important thing to know.
And it's not a binary choice. It's not either the tribe has jurisdiction or the state has jurisdiction.
Right.
As I mentioned in the criminal law arena, they both have jurisdiction.
Yes.
And why wouldn't the state want the tribes to be the most effective partner possible in combating crime, in environmental protection, and in all other domains? They should embrace this. They should embrace strong local governments. The fact that they're tribal governments, why should that scare the state? And actually, I don't think it scares this administration. I think this administration is trying to come to terms with this concept, and hopefully over the next few months, there'll be some resolution.
Let's go to the phones for a moment again. Elaine is in Bristol Bay. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask about the allotment back in the 60s. They were, I think they were getting claim jumped to DNR and BLM for those that applied. And then before AIMSA, they started establishing cities, and they're using cities to commit genocide, throwing a bunch of natives in jails and prisons. For hunting and fishing and AIMSA by itself is an act of genocide. They tried starting the tribe, of course, back in 1992 April, but all of those were compacted out in November of 1994. And I think it was $30.2 billion that was for tribal justice that was taken to regionals or the states, and they were using village councils and city councils to give that to the state.
Did you have a question, or were you just wanting to comment?
Okay, question is, how come the regional offices that were supposed to be developed in 1982?
You were breaking up a little bit there, Elaine. Your call is breaking up. Can you just restate your question? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're having trouble hearing Elaine. Maybe she could try to call back. Let's go to another caller. And here is Lorraine, who is in Anchorage. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. Buyana Chaknuk for taking my call. I think this is a very tough issue. There's been a lot of trust lost between the different agencies. I appreciate that you're bringing this tough issue up. I pray to Lord Jesus that, you know, somehow trust will be brought back to the individuals who are working on this issue. Thank you for bringing it up. And I want to say to Ethan Berkowitz for proclaiming Indigenous Peoples Day yesterday. Guyana, thank you.
Thanks, Lorraine. And also the state, Governor Walker, has made, he declared yesterday, the second Monday in October, as Indigenous Peoples Day, the first state in the nation to do so. So he sort of stole Mayor Berkowitz's thunder a bit there. But
I hope he hears us.
Yes.
You know, there's been a lot of trust lost between everyone. And I pray to Lord Jesus that he walks with us as we work on these tough issues. Guyana.
Thank you, Lorraine. You know, Lorraine raises an interesting and an important point that there's pain because of the fracture in relationships that have been caused by legal challenges and other things. So this is a time that if this, and I wanted to ask in reference to the legal challenge, the appeal that the state has currently, does the Indian canon of construction that one attorney described it to me as the Indians win rule.
Oh, that we wish that were so.
So describe what that is, Lloyd, and does that apply in this case with the state's challenge?
Well, I think that it does. The Congress has an awesome power under the Constitution. Under Article 1 of the Constitution, Congress has what the courts have concluded to be plenary, complete, absolute power over Indian affairs. And there are hardly any, though there would be some, hardly any limitations on what Congress can do in the execution of that power. because of that, and because the United States government also has a trust responsibility to protect the interests of Native American tribes, the courts early on concluded that before any act of Congress is going to be construed to curtail or eliminate any tribal authority or land right, Congress better speak clearly and perfectly clearly to the issue at hand. And so this rule of interpretation developed that if there's any ambiguity in the statute, if there's some hint of possible uncertainty, then the resolution of that ambiguity should go in favor of the tribal community, because Congress always has the power, this terrific power under Article 1, to come back and correct the court's interpretation. It's difficult to go back the other way. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is certainly Indian legislation. The Indian Reorganization Act is what we call Indian legislation, meaning legislation, both of them passed for the benefit of Native Americans, in particular for Alaska Natives. And ambiguities in those statutes should be resolved in favor of the Alaska Native peoples. And if Congress thinks that a court interpretation of those actions is incorrect, and often Congress has disagreed with the Supreme Court, then Congress can take action to amend these statutes to provide otherwise. So it's a safety valve against a possible intemperate interpretation of a statute in a way that Congress might not have intended. But if Congress clearly intended a statute to be interpreted a certain way, then the courts will follow it. The reason I chuckled earlier is that the Indian canon of interpretation, the Indians win rule, works when it's applied. And when courts choose to find no ambiguity, then they will say the canon does not apply. And then the Indians lose.
Mm. If you're just joining us, we're talking about land into trust. My guest is tribal law attorney Lloyd Miller, and we are happy to take your calls. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide to call, or locally the number is 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org, which is what Mary Bishop did, and she sent in this email question. Which ANCSA Village Corporation lands, if any, have been transferred to tribes? Do you expect this to occur more often? Does this transfer require a vote of the corporation shareholders? Do you expect applications will be made for much of that transferred ANCSA land to be transferred to federal trust? This is an excellent way to kind of open that question of, is the sky falling, and are suddenly tens of millions of acres going to be put into trust in Alaska?
Right. Well, I think the answer to that is certainly no. It's a great question. From the outset, the assumption, maybe the assumption in the question, is that we're only talking about ANCSA lands that have been transferred to tribes, but all four of the plaintiff tribes in the litigation being handled by the Native American Rights Fund and Alaska Legal Services, incidentally by Heather Kendall Miller, lead attorney, all four of those tribes are seeking to have trust status for non-ANCSA lands, I don't think there is a good inventory of all of the lands that have been transferred to tribes from ANCSA corporations. The most famous transfer is, of course, the Native village of Venati and Arctic Village, those two villages which opted to have their original reservation under ANCSA transferred to their corporations. Let me restate that. If an ANCSA corporation covered a former reservation area, then instead of selecting lands under the ANCSA formula, the corporation could just take fee title to its former reservation. So it's easy calculus. Do you get more land using the ANCSA formula, or do you get more land selecting your former reservation? Clearly, in that case, since they had 1.8 million acres in their reserve up there in the Brooks Range, the corporations established by the villages took title to the former reservation. Corporations had no interest in being corporations and managing these lands as corporations would for profit. They were interested in securing title to the land for their people, so they promptly reconveyed those lands to the tribes. Those lands to this day are owned by the tribes in fee. They did request that the Interior Department take those lands in trust years ago. That's what led to the Alaska exception and the rest of the story, if you will. I have no idea if the villages have any interest today in having those lands taken into trust. One of the things we haven't talked about in the show, and critics of the land and trust process have pointed this out, it's not easy having land and trust status. Mm-hmm. If you have land and trust status, it's owned principally by the United States government. And the United States government, like most governments, and from boroughs and tribes and state, are not the most efficient institutions at doing much of anything. There's a lot of process. And so it can be difficult to get land approvals that one needs to build a housing project or to put in a new sewer lagoon or whatever the project is when it involves trust land. And this is why people need to understand that if they do want the United States to hold the land in trust, it comes with
some regulatory burden and federal. And I want to talk about that very issue as we come back from a very short break. We're talking about land into trust today on Talk of Alaska, and we'd be happy to take your calls as we continue this conversation statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about taking land into trust and what that means. We have a question from an email listener. Mike in Yakutat wants to know if allotments can be turned over to tribes and then granted trust status. Could that happen?
That could happen. When we talk about any of these things happening, these are matters of requests.
Mm-hmm. No one can force anything, of course.
You can't. I mean, actually, one can't. Yes. One can apply to the secretary and ask the secretary to take land to trust, but there's little one can do if the secretary declines to take the land to trust.
And no one can be forced to make that request either. Bullying process going on here.
Right. There are some allottees who, for instance, the plaintiff in the Akichuk litigation is an individual, and she, her land, which was an allotment, moved out of allotment status, and then she reacquired it, but now it's owned in fee, so she'd like that land to go back into something akin to its original allotment status, which would be trust land. Mm-hmm. Very reasonable. You can imagine why anyone would want to get in the way of that, and yet because of this barrier in the regulation that existed, the Alaska exception, the secretary had no power to accept that application. Now the secretary can review it.
Let's talk about some of the questions that I've heard raised by people who have concerns about what this could mean for places like Anchorage. A lot of the Native corporations have big buildings here. They have their corporate offices here. The Siri Native Corporation, Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, has the Tikatnu Commons Mall area out there.
Right. Well, let me just jump right in. The whole Alaska Lands into Trust issue doesn't relate to Siri or any other ANCSA corporation. It relates to tribal lands. None of that land that you mentioned is owned by a tribe. So that's one thing. Thing two is the Land into Trust regulations have two parts to them, visually. One part is on-reservation acquisitions, and the other part is off-reservation acquisitions. Mm-hmm. Since we don't have reservations in Alaska, any land acquisition request would be assessed under the off-reservation.
Yes, which is a tougher test.
It's a much tougher test, and one of the elements in that test is the extent to which the land is far or near to the tribe's reservation. Well, mm-hmm. we don't have a reservation, but if you figured the proxy for a reservation might be, perhaps the Interior Department would conclude the proxy for a reservation is a village. Lands inside Anchorage are not exactly in close proximity to any village. Now, lands in proximity to Aklutna or in proximity, of course, to the native village of Aklutna, that would be different. In fact, there are allotments out where Aklutna is, restricted fee allotments. So the notion that lands in the middle of Fairbanks or Juneau or Anchorage would overnight go into trust status and go off the tax rolls is really reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of the regulatory process and what's actually possible.
And we only have a minute or so left, Lloyd, but I wanted to get to something that we were talking about just before the break, and that is something Don Young said, Congressman Young said several years ago about land in a trust. He said, why would the tribes even want to put land in a trust? You can't build an outhouse without the BIA's approval if you have trust lands. So there is there's benefits, but there's also some, I don't know if you'd want to call them drawbacks, but it does create a higher level of regulatory burden, does it not?
Certainly it does. There is a price to pay. If you want the United States to own land and trust on your behalf, then you're going to have to accept the federal government's regime for managing that land. There's good and bad in that. If you have problems of trespass, of stolen gravel, which has happened many times on allotments, I've handled some of those cases to recover value for that gravel, the United States is there as a partner to help you enforce your rights as the beneficiary of that land. So there's good. There are tremendous amounts of resources available through the United States that are only available to tribes that have trust land. So that's good. Trying to get a lease approved to make beneficial use of that land for a housing authority or some other development, that can be more complicated. Although actually, thanks to Congressman Young and others in Congress, there have been successful efforts, including the Hearth Act, and a successful effort by Congressman Young in the current Congress, in the House, to try to break down those barriers and to try to reduce the regulatory burden in developing trust land, whether in the energy domain, leasing, rights of way.
Mm-hmm. Is there places, there were reservations here, about seven at one point in time, many, about 100 years ago. Is there any idea that those former reservation lands, such as Venati, Tetlin, some of these other places, could they sort of fast-track an application to go back into trust status because they were former reservation lands?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
If you're in Venati and Venati owns in fee their former reservation land, that gives you one circumstance. If you're in Tyonek, the former reservation was not, they didn't opt to take their former reservation. Under ANCSA, they opted for the ANCSA regime, and so the former reservation is not owned in fee by the village corporation.
All right. Well, thank you so much to my guest, Lloyd Miller. We're talking today about land and a trust. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and Josh Edge on phones. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.